Hi, my name's Curly, and I'm an alcoholic codependent. Hi. We decided recently that I was the well one in the relationship, so I'm going to get to speak first. And we're going to go over basically five areas tonight, and what I want you to understand is we're just going to be able to skim these areas, even though each one of them taken separately you can go into for whole chunks of recovery. The areas are going to be the setup, and that's how, before Barb and I even met each other, how we were set up to have the relationship that we were getting ready to have. The meeting, meaning how Barb and I met each other one day, and everything was right at that time for us to enter into a relationship. All the dysfunction was rampant at that time, even though at that time we didn't understand that. We're going to enter into the diseased relationship, and that was about, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. Barb and I walked around with the disease of codependency, just wreaking havoc within our relationship. We're going to talk about the turning point. What happened to us where our relationship turned? And we're also going to talk and give you some tools about recovery. One of the things about Barb and I is that we had this toolbox, and we had no tools to put in that toolbox. We didn't know how to have a relationship. Even though, if you would have heard me talk about 6 or 7 years ago, I even spoke at a young people's convention on relationships, which was a total joke at the time. But if you would have heard me talk, I would have sounded pretty much like I knew what relationships was about, and I didn't. Where some areas we're not going to be able to get into in depth tonight, and one is sexuality in relationships. We're not going to be able to go too much into feelings and how you deal with those feelings in a relationship. We're going to barely touch on issues like fair fighting, intimacy, and communication. One thing that I want to assure everyone and to let you know is that not every relationship will survive. Not every relationship will. And there's a number of reasons for that, which we're going to get into as we go on this evening. So I'd like to welcome you here, and I just support you in sitting back and relaxing and just opening up a little bit and let us in. So with that, I want to introduce my wife and friend, Barbara.
Hi, I'm Barbara Monroe, and I have many, 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 many diseases. When I came into the program, I thought I was just an alcoholic. And now I have a compulsive, obsessive, neurotic personality. And in the last 9 years, I've found many, many things to fix me. So I just won't go into all the things that I have that are compulsive. But one of the things that I wanted to share with you tonight, just to open, is that I'm really, really glad that you're here, and I am really glad that I'm here, and I'm still married, which was debatable a couple years ago, which I'm going to be talking about with you tonight. But this is probably the most exciting part of the work that we do professionally, the work that we do personally, is to be able to share a recovery as a couple, because it doesn't happen very often. I've seen many, many of my friends come into this program and get married and then get divorced, and I've heard of many, many multiple marriages and all those kinds of things. I've had many, many relationships. I've only been married once so far, and I'm hoping that's going to continue. But this recovery that I've had personally and with Curly has been so exciting, because we turned a disastrous relationship into a 90% healthy, functional relationship, and it's so exciting to share that, because it's experience, strength, and hope for us. And we're hoping that we'll give some of that to you. So with that, I'm going to let Curly start.
The setup in our relationship started years and years and years before Barb and I met each other. And where it started was in childhood. A lot of different things happened to us as children. One of the most important things that happens is we are assigned roles. And roles, to give you a few of them, are like family scapegoat or lost child, daddy's girl, caretaker, and there are many, many more roles. There's rebel, surrogate spouse, surrogate emotional spouse, what have you. But these roles are assigned in childhood, and they become very hard, and they become very rigid. roles, the longer I'm in recovery, the more roles that I'm discovering that I was assigned as a child. What the roles do is they keep the system in balance. They'll keep the system in balance, and I'm talking about the dysfunctional family system. If mom and dad aren't dealing with the anger and pain in their marriage, what will happen is the family creates a scapegoat who catches the anger and the pain from mom and dad. My mom and dad were emotionally divorced. They were emotionally divorced when I was born. And because of that emotional divorce, I was set up as both surrogate spouse and for mom and surrogate spouse for dad. As I said, they keep the system in balance. Also, it's a way for you and me to control the system, to control the family that controlled us. It's a control mechanism that works both ways. Through these roles, we develop something that's called a false self. Something that's not real. By the time I hit recovery, I could have told you about what I thought was real, about what I thought was real about me, but there was always an undercurrent. There was always something going on. Every relationship that I ever had, and I can go all the way back to sixth grade, and her name was Barbara Barry. When I got into that relationship with Barbara Barry in sixth grade, and when summer vacation came and that relationship ended, I went through the same dynamic I went through up 3 years ago when Barbara and I were getting ready to get a divorce. The same thing happened to me. There was this thing, these roles that were going on, unbeknownst to me, where this false self was created, where Curly didn't know who Curly was. Curly was identified as rebel. Curly was identified as scapegoat. I was surrogate spouse. And I'm going to get more into my personal roles later. Mainly, I was lost child and victim of abandonment. And I want to stress that again, that I was lost child and victim of abandonment. So with that, I'm going to go more into our setup and how we were set up to have, in the beginning, this beautiful, wonderful, dysfunctional, argumentative, blaming relationship. So with that, I'm going to go back to Barbara.
I really want to share with you some of the setup that I had, and then Curly will share with you his setup. And the reason for that is what Curly was saying is that I came into this relationship at the age of 30, and my pattern was set. It had been set for 30 years about how I was going to act with him, how I was going to react with him, why I even chose him. And I didn't learn that until we were getting ready to get divorced. So it's really helpful to start knowing how you were set up as a child so you can change it, because you can't change it until you know about it. We're going to start with that then. My setup as a child was one that I was a daddy's little girl. I'm the third child of six. I was the only daughter. And so when I came along, my parents were so excited to have a daughter, and my dad picked me out to be his little girl. That sounds wonderful. And people still say it all the time, but it's a very, very dysfunctional position to put me in, because what it did was it empowered me. It said, you're more special than your mother. That's what the role says. The role says, Barbara, you're more special than your mother is to dad. And I became more special than any of my siblings. So they were jealous of me because I was special to dad. I got all the attention and I became powerful. That's a position that makes me powerful. So in all my relationships after that, I was in the one-up position of the powerful one. And that's real dysfunctional when you try to be in an equal relationship. The second thing that happened to me is I became my dad's surrogate spouse. That kind of goes along with daddy's little girl, but what it meant to me was that my mother was dying from alcoholism. She died 10 years ago. So for 20 years of her life, she sat on the couch and she drank herself to death. My oldest brother killed himself, and after he killed himself, my parents didn't know what to do. My dad went off to work and my mother laid on the couch and she slowly drank herself to death. As she was drinking, someone needed to become mom in the family, so my dad took me, and I became intimate on an emotional level with my father. It's a covert sexual way to be intimate with a parent. What happens is that I'm already married to my father, and so when I try to get married as an adult, it doesn't work because I've already got a husband. And for any of you people that are surrogate spouses, you know what I'm talking about. Because Curly was always in competition in my head with my father. My father was better than, he was more responsible, he took care of me better, he was bigger than life. So Curly never measured up, and he never understood it at all. And I didn't understand it either, but it was really hard because Dad was always in the way. And that's the setup. My father still calls me, he lives up in Payson. He's retired right now, and he still calls me up, and he still talks to me about the family. I'm the one he talks about the family. I'm his wife still, and he's remarried, and I'm married, so it's really strange. We've tried to pull away, and we're just working on not being a surrogate spouse, because he still doesn't understand it, because I'm the only one in recovery. Mom's mom, when my mother started sitting on the couch and drinking, there were 5 kids left. I had an older brother who became Dad in the family. I became the mom, and I raised 3 of my younger brothers from the age of 13. I mean, I taught them how to drive. I taught them about girls. I taught them how to wear their hair. I taught them how to dress. And I still am their mom. 2 of them, I still sit in mom position to them. I'm really trying to move out of it. One of them is only 4 years younger than me, and I still caretake him sometimes. It's a real... It's a terrible role to put your child in. What happened to me in my adult life is I never had children. And I never wondered why I didn't want to have children. It's because I've already had a family. Why would I want to do it again? So I still have 3 kids, which Curly gets to share, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. He's now a parent, a step-parent to my brothers. Being mom's mom means that I took care of her, so I didn't get taken care of. I didn't get to have a mother. I didn't learn how to be a female. I didn't learn how to be a wife. I had no idea what to do as an adult when I grew up. I had no idea how to do that because instead of my mother taking care of me, I took care of her. I dressed her. I took her out to get her hair done. I talked to her about her problems. I told her what to do. And I really took care of the house. You know, I was taking care of the cooking and the cleaning and all that kind of stuff in my teen years before I escaped. So I took care of her, and I became a little parent to her and to my brothers. In this setup, I became very powerful, and what happened to me was I became very needless. When you are needless, you have no idea when someone says to you, take care of yourself, you don't know what that means. You have no idea what that means. And also, you won't let anybody help take care of your needs. And that's really difficult when we get into a 12-step program because the first thing I learned when I got sober was that I had to get a sponsor, which I didn't want to do, and I had to call people, which I didn't want to do, and I had to let people be there for me, and I didn't even know what that meant. And it took me years to start letting anybody be there for me, much less Curly. What happened with being needless, which showed me in a large way how that was with Curly and I, because I would not let him take care of me. I mean, I would take care of the car. I would take care of the gas. If I didn't know how to do it, I wouldn't ask him. Sometimes I still called my father, because I'm, you know, a surrogate spouse, and asked him for things. I never asked Curly to help me out. He never saw me cry, because in our family, you don't do feelings anyway, because I'm an adult child. But the one big one you didn't do was pain. So I not only don't know how to do pain, but I would never let him see it. So if I ever had to do any pain, I'd go run in the bedroom and cry a little bit and then come out and be strong and tough. When we got to therapy about 3 years ago, we were sitting in the therapist's office, and this was in the deterioration part of our marriage, and we'll talk about that again with you as the story goes. I was sitting in the therapist's office, and I said to him, you know, I don't think you could ever be there for me. I said, I know that's not about you now. I know that's about my parents never being there for me. But I don't think you'd ever be there for me. I'm so afraid to let you because I'm afraid you're going to fail me and not be there for me. And then I'm going to know that you won't be there for me, that nobody will ever be there for me. And he looked at me after 5 years of being together. We work together. We live together. We do most of our hobbies together. We really do a lot of things together. And he looked at me and he said, I didn't know you had any needs. See, that's how needless I was. I looked like I didn't need anything. So I was really needless. And that was, it's really hard to be intimate in a relationship because if you are needless, nothing comes in and nothing goes out. You are walled up and you take care of everything yourself, and you can't be intimate when you're walled up. So I was not able to be intimate with him at all. That's just a very little bit of my setup. I was severely neglected and I was severely abandoned. Those are my main issues, which is spiritual abuse. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, but spiritual abuse means that I didn't feel like I mattered to my parents because they totally neglected me and they were not there for me. My mom was drunk and depressed. My father was out working. He's a workaholic. My mother, alcoholic. And so I was all by myself trying to grow up without any parents. And so I was totally neglected and totally abandoned. And so I walked around thinking that no one would want to be there for me and they wouldn't even want to talk to me because I was totally neglected. And so that's a little bit of my setup. There's a lot more. We just don't have that kind of time to tell you about it. But this is what I came into this relationship with.
One of my real significant early childhood memories was Curly sitting up in a tree, and I think I'm about 9 years old, and I used to climb up this tree. And when I got up in the tree, I would sit there and just cry and cry and cry. And I'd come back out of the tree, and I'd go home and do whatever it was I was doing home. One of my most powerful roles as a child was lost child. Clinically, what that means is there was really never anybody there for me emotionally or physically. But emotionally, nobody was there. And on top of that, one of the main things in my family of origin is that we weren't permitted to feel. As a male, I grew, and what I grew into was it was okay for me to express and to feel anger, but it was not okay for me to feel pain. So there was never anybody there for me. The rest of my life, what I attempted to do was to fill that up, meaning having somebody there for me, just me all the time. That's one definition of lost child, and that's the type of lost child I was. There's another lost child definition, and that's the kid that just sort of sits over by themselves, and they're playing, and they're doing very good, and they're relieving the system that way, just by being good over in the corner. But underneath that, also, there is nobody there for them, especially emotionally. They're not getting time, attention, or direction, and in most cases, there's nobody there physically. The scene in my house was my father reading the newspaper, my mom's watching television, and I'm lying on the floor, and I can remember so many instances trying to talk to mom or dad about what was going on with me, and I would hear things like, "Buck up, when are you going to grow up?" And, you know, to a 10-year-old or to an 11-year-old, when you're going to grow up gets kind of confusing. I got real confused about that. Next role, and this is my core role, was abandonment. That is something that I have been in most of my life, is abandonment. When Barbara Berry, as I told you earlier, left me for summer vacation in the sixth grade, I can remember this strange set of feelings starting within me. And I would get on my bicycle, and I'd go way over to where she lived, and I'd sort of get on this hill on my bike and stare down at the house like that. You know, maybe she would come out, and to this day, I don't know why I didn't go down and say hello, but that's the way it was. And in every relationship that I ever had, when that relationship ended, something started happening to me that I didn't understand. The best definition I can ever come up with for abandonment is psychic terror. And that's what it feels like to me. I believe at times past when I have been in abandonment that I cannot connect with my drug, and the drug of choice when I'm in abandonment is usually the relationship, the woman in the relationship that has just left me. I cannot connect with anybody here. My words seem very shallow. I can't get the feelings up. And the secret inside of me is that I'm not connected within this universe. That's what abandonment feels like to me. Once again, and it's happened many, many times, Curly was left alone. This little kid, a little 13, 10-year-old boy, was left alone with nobody there for him. And the best I could ever do was blame the other person. That's as far as I could ever get. Look what they did to me. That is the most powerful issue I deal with today, is abandonment. I'm also a victim of emotional abuse. The main part of this emotional abuse was criticism. You know, there's a Chinese water torture, and they drip water on your head, and at first it's okay, and then after a length of time, it sounds like a cannon's exploding every time that drip hits. That was how my emotional abuse went. I never did it right. You don't do that right, you don't do this right, you'll never be able to do it right. Why'd you even try and do it? Look what you've done here, you didn't do this, you can't go there. And it was constant and relentless from my mother. The abuse from my father was my father never jumped in and protected me. Even though he agreed with me that I was being abused, he never protected me from my mother. I was sexually abused by an uncle. I was incested, and I'm an incest survivor, which caused infinite problems, and to this day still causes some problems within my marriage with Barb, and that's around sexuality. I was also a victim of physical abuse. My grandfather beat me on a real regular basis. He'd throw me down the stairs, smack me, slap me, and do all kinds of stuff. By the time I hit a 12-step program, what I would have looked like to you in my first days in AA, what I would have looked like was someone standing against the wall, very hard looking. The feeling you probably felt coming off me was anger. And what I'm doing is I'm keeping away from you, and I'm appearing very needless and very hard. And if you came up to talk to me, I would have assured you that I was very needless and very hard and didn't need you at all. Leave me alone. What was going on inside of Curly? I was so needy, I didn't know what to do. Just so needy. I remember the first time somebody really shook my hand and put their arm around me or something like that and just sort of expressed some love to me. I walked away and I was feeling shame. It was like, God, well, this guy will never know me. Or pretty soon these people will really find out who I am, and you know, and then they're going to leave for sure. I can remember going to meetings and I would talk on whatever was being talked about at that meeting, and I'd go back out of my car and I'd start crying, but nobody could see my pain. It was okay if you saw my anger, but nobody could see my pain and nobody could see my fear. Those two feelings in me were the ones that I had to get in touch with if this relationship between Barb and I was going to survive. I had to get in touch with those two relationships, feelings. What happened to me, after a lot of nurturing from people and a lot of talking, is that I started getting needy. And when I started getting needy, I started changing and I started growing. That's the setup. That's what happened to Barbara. And by now, Barbara's walking around and she's working over at the crossroads. And by now, Curly's walking around and I'm have this scowl on my face and I'm pretending like I don't like you because you don't like me, and you know, most of this stuff's beneath me and I'm going through that and I'm real mean look on my face. What was really going on, once again, when we met each other with these two histories, it was as if I had an umbilical cord in my hand. And I'm walking around swinging this umbilical cord, and I'd keep trying to plug it into Mom, or I'm sorry, to a relationship. I'd keep trying to plug it in, and it wouldn't fit there, and it wouldn't fit here, and it doesn't fit here. And then pretty soon, one day, we're walking in front of the crossroads, and there's a friend of mine standing there, and he said, Curly, I'd like you to meet Barbara. It went in. Contact. I had my next relationship. There's certain things that happen at the beginning of a relationship that happens to all of us, but the umbilical cord was in. I had found Mom once again, and if she wasn't Mom, I damn sure was going to make her into Mom. I was going to get what I needed from her. So at that point, that's the meeting when Curly met Barbara.
Curly was talking about lots of different reasons why two people will meet. There's two things that I wanted to share with you about what happens when people meet, when you're meeting someone. What happens is that we as adults become comfortable in the uncomfortability of someone who is like our mother or our father in behavior. So, and the example of that is Curly was a criticized child, so he feels comfortable being criticized. I mean, he doesn't like it, but it's comfortable because someone's been doing it to him for 43 years now. Someone who, for example, for me, who has been neglected and having parents not be there for me emotionally, I will look for a man that will not be there for me emotionally. And that's because it is comfortable in the uncomfortability of all that. So if you're wondering why you keep picking the same person, different face, maybe one's taller than the other, but they still do the same thing over and over again, or maybe you pick mom and then you pick dad, and then if you're lucky, you pick one that's got both. All the characteristics of mom and dad in one person. That's really cause for sparks and fighting. Another thing that happens, though, when we're meeting someone is that we learn by watching mom and dad, we learn who to marry. Because we watch their characteristics, and that's who we find to marry. What happens is, when we're little, what we want more than anything else in the whole world is for mommy and daddy to love us unconditionally. That happens, you know, they're our first gods. We want mom and dad to love us absolutely unconditionally. We want them to love us and tell us we're wonderful, and we want them to see our life spark. Amy Fisher is doing a lot of work in the spiritual wound, and currently I do some work with Amy. She trained me over at the Meadows, and she talks about that, the spiritual wound and the life spark, the part of me that is wonderful and loves life and thinks that life's going to be wonderful and that is spontaneous and has joy. See, I wanted my parents to show me that I had a life spark and to see it and say, Barbara, you're wonderful because you have a life spark. Well, they didn't do that. My parents neglected me and abandoned me. So because that didn't happen with mom and dad, I've been searching over and over again, man after man, for someone to see that I was wonderful, to see my life spark. And that's what we do. See, most of us came into whatever program we came into, whether it would be CODA or AA or whatever, whatever 12-step program we came into, wanting to like ourselves, but we didn't. You know, if you're like me, I didn't like myself very much. I had very low self-esteem, and I wanted someone to like me. Well, I wanted someone to see my life spark, so I was hoping some male was going to see my life spark. And what happened is I met Curly and wanted him to see my life spark. And so we keep finding a mate to do what our parents didn't do. It's called mastering the relationship. I keep trying to master it with Joe and with John and with Mark, and it doesn't ever work because there's so much dysfunction. And what I really need to do, and we're going to be talking about that before, and we've been talking about it in all of recovery from CODA, is we have to grieve the loss of never getting it from our parents. Because no one else can show you your life spark. You have to do that yourself. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. But what happened is I met Curly, and he saw my life spark. And so I said, I'm going to get hooked into this guy for one reason, because he sees my life spark. And that's because I had so much joy. I'm much more child than adult anyway. I have a lot of fun, and I kid around a lot, and I really have a lot of spontaneity in my life. I don't know who I got it from. In spite of my childhood, I still have that. And he saw that, and he saw my life spark, and I saw his life spark. And that's really how we met. That's the good news. The bad news was that I was a major caretaker. I fixed people because I'd been fixing my family, because, you know, I'm a surrogate spouse and I was my brother's mom. So I was a fixer, and I also was a savior because I was going to save my family from all their disaster. That's what I did, the roles I had in my childhood. And look who I find. I find a guy that's a lost child who would love someone to fix him, if it was fixable, and someone to fix his abandonment. And I was going to do that. I was going to fix him. He was coming out of a relationship, and I was going to save him. That's how we met. Hand in glove, dysfunction and dysfunction. There was nothing functional about really how we met. We knew nothing about codependency at that time. We just met, And for a while, it went really well. It went really well for at least 2 or 3 weeks, I'm sure. So if you're wondering, as you think back as I'm talking, if you would think back in all your relationships, even maybe the one you're in right now, and you try to figure out about your roles and what you do in your relationships and what the other person does, it's usually hand in glove. They fit. You will fit perfectly in the dysfunction. The problem is unless you get healthy and into function, you're going to eventually break up and meet somebody else. That's what happens, and you're going to meet the same person again with a different face. That happens over and over again. Or you'll say, my God, this person was so angry, and then you find someone totally passive. But you'll go from one extreme to the other. So unless you work on the recovery, you're never going to be healthy. I'm going to tell you now a little bit about our disease relationship. What happened was we had a pattern of arguments. Everything went the same way. We probably had 150 arguments. We were trying to talk about this. Every time we try to do this lecture, we try to think of new arguments we had, and we can't remember many of them, thank God. But they were so meaningless. The reasons why we fought were so meaningless. But they had a pattern to them. And that's what you want to look for, is you want to look for the pattern, because you got to change the pattern. And I want you to know your pattern comes from what you learned as a child. You don't think up your pattern today. You never think, I'm gonna react and respond differently today. You respond and react the way you did as a child until you learn differently. We're gonna talk to you a little bit more about that later. But I'm gonna share with you a few of our arguments to explain to you how we were in our dysfunction. The first one is that we had a time issue. I don't know if any of you have a time issue, but this time issue was absolutely horrendous. And what the problem was is that we believed opposite things about being places at a certain time. An example of that is that Curly and I would say, he'd say to me, I'll meet you over at the crossroads for the 8:30 meeting on Wednesday. And I'd say, fine, I'd love to. You know, we were still dating then. So his time issue says that you have to be someplace early. And his mother taught him that if you get someplace early, you're a good boy. If you get someplace on time, it's debatable. And if you get someplace late, you're really a bad boy. And believe me, we hear that today when we're at his house with his parents. You know, we go over to visit. We're every place really early when we take them someplace. So that's really ingrained. So he's going to be a good boy, of course, and he gets to this meeting. It's an 8:30 meeting. He gets there 7:45. So he's doing fine. It's 7:45. He gets himself a cup of coffee, has a cigarette, and he's walking around the crossroads and waiting for me. My time issue is the exact opposite. I grew up in a family, so there's 8 people in the family. We went every place late. Funerals, marriages, doctors, it didn't matter. We went to church, sat in the front pew late. I was so always embarrassed. Front, late. So my family knows nothing about time, and I was always late. No matter if I was supposed to be someplace at 10 and a friend called me at 5 till, I would talk to them because I didn't have the concept, because I didn't learn it. So now I'm supposed to meet him at 8:30, and he's doing fine. It's 7:45, and he's having his coffee, and he's thinking about seeing me and maybe what he's done during the day. He's really doing good. He's feeling pretty good. Gets to be 8 o'clock. He's still feeling pretty good, looking at his watch, wondering why I'm not there yet. 7:45, he's getting nervous, getting a little angry because he's wondering where I am. I get 8:30, I'm still not there. He's getting pissed. He's really angry, and all of his issues are up. His issues, you don't care about me. If you cared about me, you'd be here early, because that's what you're supposed to do. I'm a bad girl. See, now I got his stuff. I'm a bad girl because I'm late. So I saunter in at 9:20. And I'm really happy to see him. You know, I really like him. We're newly in this relationship. And I sit down and I say, hi, how are you? And he goes, you're late. I can't believe it. How rude. If you cared about me, you'd be here on time. And we would fight. And I can't tell you how many times this happened. I would look at him and say, don't try to control me. So I have this, you're controlling me, and he has, how rude, you don't care about me. Totally different issues, and we fought in the parking lots of meetings. We fought during meetings. We pulled ourselves out of the spiritual meeting and fought. We would fight at church. It didn't matter where we fought. We would fight and fight and fight over time. And 4 years later, bloody, we sat in our therapist's office and told the therapist what time meant to us. And once we did that, now we really work through it. I mean, I say to him, when do you want to leave the house? And he tells me, and I'm always ready on time. Sometimes about 10 minutes early, he still says, well, Barbara, it's time to go. And I'll say, no, I have 10 minutes, because I know exactly how much time I have. But we have it worked out, so he doesn't think I don't care about him, and I don't think he's trying to control me. And I realized that I was really wrong anyway, not being on time. That's something I've worked through. But so he did help me out, but it was a horrible struggle. Another example is, remember I told you that I'm a daddy's little girl? And being a daddy's little girl, I was special to Dad. I was the most important little girl in the universe to my father. So, of course I expect to be special to him, more special than anybody. Curly has, in the last 4 years, become his parents' caretaker, and that's a choice that he's taken because they're both dying. And so he's their major caretaker, and he does everything for them, and I sometimes help him. But when he started doing this, when he started taking care of his parents, because they were getting slowly debilitated, it was progressive to where, like, his dad wasn't driving anymore, and then all of a sudden he was taking them to the store and taking them to the doctors and all that kind of stuff. I was crazy with that. He would be gone taking care of his parents, and I would start feeling abandoned, not cared about, not special, abused, and I would start criticizing his mother. I mean, I would start picking at him. The dynamic is that I would start feeling some fear about him not caring about me, and I wasn't real important to him, and I was also feeling some shame. Shame would be underneath this, not feeling good enough for him, like mom's more important. I would like be in competition with his mom. So I would be criticizing his mother. He'd get angry. He'd go into anger, and when he'd go into anger, I'd go right into shame and fear. Because he was angry at me, because I don't do anger. When someone gets angry at me, I go into shame and fear, because that's my father. When he'd get angry, I'd go into shame and fear. I'm doing the same thing with him, and then I would get angry, and now we're fighting. The dynamic went over and over and over again. When I would not feel special to him, I would start criticizing sideways, because I didn't do anger very well, criticizing his mother. He'd get angry. When he got angry, I'd go into shame and fear. And then I'd get angry and we'd be fighting. And these fights would last for days, days and days. And we'd go into things like, when we first started knowing each other, it was just little things. We'd criticize each other, and what we called, we'd take out our pistols and we'd pop each other, like, I don't like you very much anyway, or I don't like the way you look, or Curly's famous was, why don't you deal with your father? When I'd be angry at him, and that would send me just crazy. And then, as we got more intimate, we'd bring out the rifles, and then we'd really be shooting each other, and we'd be saying really disastrous things like, I don't even like the way you talk, or I don't like your family at all, or you don't make enough money, or give me just on and on. And then we'd bring out the cannons, and by the end of our fighting, we were blowing each other apart just with criticism. I mean, we were tearing our relationship apart little by little, like Curly's talking about those drops of water. Little things we were saying that you could hardly forget. You know, you might forgive each other, but you couldn't forget what was going on. I have a couple of other examples just to show you that it doesn't matter what we're fighting about, it's always just the pattern. Another thing that happened with with Curly and I is when he was doing this stuff with his parents, he was really going into a lot of emotional strain and stress on himself because he's caretaking them, trying to help me take care of the house, and we're both working still. So he has like three jobs. So he's taking care of his parents, and also being in that family situation, he's getting, you know, still having family issues. You know, like every time you go home, You go into the child again. He'd be with his parents and he wouldn't be the adult. Like if mom would be critical, he'd still feel the feelings about that he's always felt. So he was having lots of overwhelming stuff going on, and he would come home and try to talk to me about it. And because I'm trying to be his friend, he would try to talk to me about it, and he'd be sharing his anger about having to go to the damn store the fourth time this week just to get milk, and that he was really tired, and pain maybe seeing his dad because his dad was deteriorating slowly and having to watch that and all the grief that was going on watching them die. And what I do always is fix it. He can't feel pain. We got to fix it. I tell him what to do. And that's my thing. I did that in my family of origin. I would try to fix him all the time. And he would start to say to me, "You don't even let me have my feelings. It's, you know, I don't even get to have my feelings because you're telling me everything has to be wonderful all the time." So that was a huge one. And then he'd get angry at me because I'd be fixing his feelings. I'd go into shame and fear again. Shame about not doing it right, him not loving me, not getting his approval. And then I'd get angry and then we'd be fighting again. So he doesn't get to share his feelings. I'm trying to fix him. And see, all this stuff is the stuff I've learned. I learned a long time ago as a child. He never asked me to solve his problems. I'm just doing that because I'm a fixer, and that doesn't allow him to do his own stuff, you know, have his own feelings. The last thing to share with you, this was a huge one for us and continues to be, and I share this a lot, but it's such a good example of what happened to us. Curly awfulizes. He learned to awfulize about things. So it was the very worst. And I learned to not deal at all. So we're at the opposite sides of anything that happens. And the way that we learned about this is Curly's mom had some bypass surgery. It's been about 4 or 5 years now. And the Dr. Dietrich did it.